We're on a mission to explore how emerging technologies, media, robotics, and data and behavioral science will solve humanity's most pressing challenges. From education, mobility, energy, food and water supplies, the environment, employment, all the way to disease and basic human rights. Nothing is off limits. This episode is brought to you by Beverage Universe. They have every flavor to help you stay young, beautiful, and thirsty. Go to beverageuniverse.com for your next flavor experience. I am excited to introduce our guest today, Miko Matsumura. Miko is a serial entrepreneur and the co-founder of Evercoin, which is a Silicon Valley-based cryptocurrency exchange platform. He is also a general partner at Gumi Cryptos Capital, which is a $30 million venture capital fund focused on early-stage blockchain startups. Also, a venture partner at Bitbull Capital, which is a cryptocurrency fund of funds. Miko is also an advisor to Arrington XRP Capital and one of the founding fathers and chief ambassadors of the first wave of the internet as chief evangelist for the Java language platform at Sun Microsystems. Miko has over 25 years of enterprise software marketing experience in Silicon Valley and has raised over $50 million in venture capital for open source startups. He holds a master's degree in neuroscience from Yale University, where he worked on abstract computational neural networks. Welcome, Miko, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, yeah, it's a great pleasure to be here.
So can you take us through your early entrepreneurial journey and how you got to where you are today?
Yes, it's such a winding and twisty road, right? Because I got my academic chops at Yale in neuroscience. So, you know, it's been a really interesting windy road. At the time, I was doing abstract computational neural networks using C++ on, you know, Unix machines. So, you know, I really got into that. And, you know, eventually I decided that I wasn't really cut out to be in pure science. But the science ended up, you know, being a great thing for me later on. But eventually what happened was I kind of found my way to Silicon Valley and, you know, eventually sort of fell in love with this Java programming language. So, you know, it really had all of the things to take care of all the shortcomings that I found in C++, and it really started taking off. So that was kind of where I kind of got my start, is really in developer evangelism, platform marketing, and, you know, I really got excited about this stuff. So, you know, I think that's where the road started for me. After that, I caught the startup bug. So, you know, then I've been involved in venture capital and startups ever since then. So that's been sort of the road for me, a very, very twisty road, lots of turns.
What were some of your first startups?
Yeah. So I did this one startup straight out of Sun. And it's amazing when you go from a big company to your first startup, like you just make lots of mistakes, right?
Right.
So, you know, so I went to this startup and it's not that interesting what it's called because it doesn't really exist anymore. You know, and we pretty much, I joined, you know, I got a fancy title and I, you know, but the thing that was amazing that I didn't know about is that they didn't actually have any money. So it was a really interesting time. I learned how to raise venture capital, eventually raised $5.25 million for their Series A. But, you know, the whole thing was a big stretch because I worked there for like 9 months. The whole time I didn't actually know how to raise VC, and it took me 9 months to figure it out. You know, and during that time, like, you know, no paycheck to speak of or anything else. So it's, you know, very kind of a abrupt cold water experience, right? Because, you know, it's sink or swim, you know, and do or die. And, you know, rightly so, which is what I'm increasingly appreciative of, is that, you know, Silicon Valley and venture and startups is really in that mood. It's in the mood of like sink or swim, do or die. And that energy is a vital energy, right? It's an energy of like really that drives and motivates people to do extraordinary things.
So what was the startup?
Well, so it was kind of application service provider before it was cool. So it was kind of like trying to do almost like an SAP as a service. So this was way kind of early days before Salesforce. So it was really futuristic vision, but like obviously vision is only so much of the game, right? Execution becomes a big part of the game. So, you know, I was enamored of the vision. I thought applications, at the time it was called Application Service Providers or ASP, and it eventually became SaaS, right? So SaaS became kind of this dominant force. Obviously Salesforce is a big deal in that. And, you know, so eventually that happened. But, you know, one of the other things that I really learned the hard way is I learned that, like, my vision of what's about to happen is usually, like, early. So I learned kind of the hard way that, you know, if I think something's about to happen, it's probably going to take 3-4 years or 5 years for it to actually happen.
So you raised 9 months into your first startup, you learned how to raise VC and you raised $5 million. And then what happened?
So, you know, basically we struggled to get product market fit, which is really ultimately like where it's at. So, you know, I think the thing to learn, one of the tough things to learn in the marketing profession is that you're really a one-to-many specialist and not a zero-to-one specialist, right? So what it means is it means that you want the engineering and product geniuses to have already sold the thing to the first customer, and then you can come in and make that replicable, right? So if you're in the marketing profession, you know, the way I see it is it's sort of really related to kind of scaling something that's already been, you know, achieved, as opposed to kind of doing something from the ground up, which is hard. It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, from the ground up is the hardest.
That's zero to one. Mm. That's Peter Thiel's book.
So then after that startup, what came next for you?
Well, you know, a series of startups. And, you know, this actually became, you know, so I did a startup called Infravio. And, you know, that was a lot nicer because we ended up kind of selling that one, you know, in a cash acquisition. It was, you know, positive and liquid for everyone. And then, you know, it sold to a company called WebMethods, which we then sold that to a company called Software AG, a German software company. And then eventually we grew Software AG to like €1 billion in annual revenue. So this was kind of like this big roll-up trajectory for me. So I ended up working there for a while, and you know, I really learned a heck of a lot about data, and I learned a lot about enterprise software through that journey, two successive acquisitions.
How did you encounter blockchain and cryptocurrency for the first time? Like, when did you see that wave coming?
Yeah, so I'm not super OG. Like, I'm not this old school guy. Like, what happened was I ran across a Bitcoin checkout at my local cafe. So in Palo Alto, there's the Coupa Cafe, and they had a Bitcoin checkout. So, you know, this is like 2016. So, you know, it was before kind of this big run-up, but like, you know, it definitely was not, you know, some of these really serious like 2012 types, right? So for me, that was kind of eye-opening. So I decided I would do a little mining project, and I would try to mine out a cup of tea worth of Bitcoin. So that was kind of my first entree into the field. But, you know, the thing that dragged me in most professionally was I worked on another open source software startup called Hazelcast, and Talib Özturk, the CEO and founder of Hazelcast, actually pulled me aside and said, hey, we've got to get into this blockchain thing. You know, let's start a company, which turned out to be Evercoin. So, you know, he was the one that really got both of my feet squarely in the space.
So tell me a bit about Evercoin. How did you come up with the idea, and how did you guys develop it and build it?
Yeah, so Evercoin has been through like this amazing sort of pinball machine that I think sort of blitzscaling venture capital folks in Silicon Valley call the idea maze. So, you know, I don't want to kind of belabor this with kind of depicting our journey through the idea maze, but I can tell you where we have arrived, which is the destination of Evercoin is really a safer or safest crypto hardware wallet. So the thing that we've really decided is that, you know, the first decision point becomes whether you're holding your own cryptographic keys or whether you're not. Right. And so we're of the school of what people call your keys, your crypto. Right. So we're really into self-custody and ownership. So as soon as you fork that way, then what ends up happening is you end up starting to get more involved in both securing that and also ensuring that there are no accidents or mistakes in self-custody. So that's where we've gone. So I think we now have, I think, the safest crypto wallet and exchange. So, you know, from our perspective, safest means non-custodial, which means that there's no third party holding your asset.
Well, it's a brave, brave venture, I think, to have a crypto exchange nowadays, just with all the commotion and things going on in general. How did you guys achieve that?
Yeah, it's been an amazing road. I think from our perspective, the thing that's very important is to make sure that you're in everything for the right reasons, right? So, you know, the reason why that becomes important is that I think all markets kind of go up and down, right? And all startup journeys go up and down, right? So if you're really kind of, you know, in it to make a quick buck, like I saw a tweet the other day that I really enjoyed, which is Bitcoin is not a get rich quick scheme. It is a don't get poor slowly scheme, right? So I thought that was clever, right?
And that's good.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. And so the mood around it is like, you know, the mood is more like, why are you committed to this? And the way I look at this is I look at it personally as my ethos being that I've been 25 years in open source software, and I've actually seen the huge benefits of open source software. It's one of the few places on the internet that seems to have like radically reversed the tragedy of the commons, right? Which is that if you look inside of a place like GitHub, you just see what I claim as trillions of dollars worth of software that have been built and offered to everyone for free. I mean, it's almost like the Burning Man gift economy on the internet, you know,
right.
Like people are just offering their hard work and labor to everyone else and anyone else for $0, right? So that's an amazing thing. And to me, the biggest clash in the world now is basically, is money going to ruin open source, or is open source going to like penetrate money and make it like virtuous and you know, much like one of the best places on the internet?
I like where you're going with that. Now, as far as Bitcoin money, now that we're on this topic.
Yeah.
A lot of people are saying that we're in a crypto economy / you know, ICOs of the past kind of bubble. What are your thoughts on, you know, if we are in fact in a bubble, and if, you know, Bitcoin itself and, you know, all the other cryptos that are dependent on the Bitcoin all rise at the same time? Let's say, you know, today it's at whatever, 8,000 per coin. Let's say in 2 weeks it goes up to 90,000 per coin and then drastically drops back down to, let's say, 8,000 per coin. What will that volatility do to our global economy, in your opinion?
Yeah. So first of all, I really would love to address this idea of bubble, right? Because I feel like people really focus on this word and they're using it in a pejorative sense, right? Because, you know, they say, oh, it's an economic bubble, right? So obviously that implies it's temporary, right? But for example, what's known is that the global economy is in fact also a bubble. And what's actually known is that the universe itself is a bubble that's about maybe 13.8 billion years old, and it's possible that that will like pop or contract back down to a single dot. So like, you know, so the thing that is important to kind of understand is kind of like whether it is a harmful, like as Warren Buffett says, sort of rat poison, or whether it's beneficial, right? And I think the jury is out ultimately, right? I'm placing my faith and bet on open source. And to me, the place where this twists is it twists around, will people say, like, I think Cyndi Lauper says money changes everything, you know? And the question is like, will money poison open source, or will open source liberate money, right? And when you look at that, I don't actually know how this turns out. Like, I would like to see open source actually kind of penetrate the financial infrastructure, culminating in a much better global financial infrastructure. So when you look at the history of bubble economies, like, people point to things like tulip mania in, you know, the Netherlands. that's really, I would call it a fictitious market bubble. When you actually look deeply into it, it's actually something that's apocryphal. So Tulip Mania kind of didn't happen the way people report it. But the point being that it's already clear that Bitcoin is not Tulip Mania, because what happens in Tulip Mania is there's this very, it's called an infinite hangover, right? Which is the price goes exponential, then it crashes to zero or near zero. Obviously, a tulip bulb has a nominal value because tulips are pretty. But it stays at the nominal value or zero, depending on what it is, the asset is. And it stays there forever, right? Because people are like, what were we thinking? You know, that was insane. Let's never do that again.
Right.
And if you look at the price of Bitcoin, it's dropped by 25%, I think 7 times in its history. And each time it's gone from there to an all-time high, which is clearly not like a Tulip Mania style bubble. It, you know, it may have other properties that reflect a bubble-like quality. But to me, the bigger question becomes, is there a benefit to this type of volatility? I think it's a little unfortunate, but we're in the era of what Mark Andreessen calls the disagreeable era. And so what Bitcoin is doing is maybe a little bit like what Donald Trump does on Twitter, right? Which is what Bitcoin is doing is Bitcoin's getting everyone's attention by kind of like blowing up and then dropping and then blowing up and then dropping. And everyone's kind of now just unable to avert their eyes, right? Like they just can't stop looking at Bitcoin. And it's unfortunate that it's doing that, but that's what it does. And it does that essentially automatically. So the thing that's really unfortunate, and it's in a way why maybe Warren Buffett feels kind of very negative towards it, right? Because, it, you know, what is that? That's new. It's a new creature. And I like to say this. I like to say that, so the Keynesians have this concept called animal spirits that occupy the economy, right? We're sitting here in New York, very close to Wall Street, and there's a giant bull statue there, right? The other animal spirit that's super common in the Keynesian model is the bear, right? So the bear hides and hibernates, and the bull charges ahead, right? But Bitcoin represents almost what I call a third animal spirit, which is one of the origin stories of Bitcoin and the earliest days of Bitcoin marketing, is that Eric Voorhees, the CEO of Shapeshift, created a billboard with a honey badger on it. And it was honey badger represents Bitcoin. And Roger Ver actually sponsored the placement of that on some major highway. And so the honey badger is actually the third animal spirit in the market. And it's just this relentless creature that represents like Bitcoin, right? So to me, the idea of this third animal spirit is this idea of like this incredibly weird and unknown force in the market. And that that's in some ways needed. And what I mean by it's in some ways needed is that in 2008, what we saw is the effects of over-centralization. And if you look at the stock price of Lehman Brothers, that's Tulip Mania. Because the stock price of Lehman Brothers went from $600 billion to zero, and it stayed at zero.
Right.
And everyone after that were like, what were we thinking? Let's never do that again. Right. So that's what Tulip Mania looks like.
So when you talk about volatility having a benefit, tell me a bit about that. What are the benefits of having that type of volatility?
Yeah, so you know, I think the best way to look back at it is harken back to the early days of the internet. So, you know, if you remember the internet bubble, like one of the amazing things that happened is that you get this incredible vector of change, right? So the energy and the forces that come into play actually enable the investment in the infrastructure. Right, so that's what happens during these bubbles is that infrastructural investment that would otherwise not be possible like become possible. So it's really this huge push to build the roads, you know, and then like maybe this contractile feeling. But if you look at what came out of the internet bubble, you know, it's really the largest, most valuable public companies in the world, like the Apples and the Facebooks and the Microsofts and the Googles. And obviously, like, we're troubled by how they're behaving now. And so we're reaching kind of the limitations of the benefits of that. But, like, you know, we're the stakes are we're rebuilding the internet now based on basically the storage and transfer of value. And mm-hmm. and that means safety and cryptography, and it means kind of a new internet. And that's those are the stakes.
So you talk a bit about internet of value and open source money. Explain what exactly that means when you say, let's start with open source money.
Yeah, so to me, the most important thing that's happened, and this is a big, big change, which is that for the past 30 plus years, we've had an internet that's been optimized for the use case of storing and transmitting information, right? So it's this beautiful network of transmitting information very cheaply and very quickly anywhere, right? So the thing that the internet has not been good at is there's been no internet protocol for storing and transmitting value, which is really like economic value, right? So, you know, Bitcoin is really the first example of this kind of storage and transmission medium of value. And the thing that makes it kind of this crazily open source beast is that not only is the code open source as you would expect, right? The governance model is classically open source, so anyone can copy and fork the thing. But the thing that Satoshi Nakamoto did in the white paper is he actually posited a new concept, which is almost like what I would call an open source runtime. And what does that mean? What I mean by an open source runtime is that who runs the bank of Bitcoin? And it's basically anyone who wants to download the code and run it, mm-hmm. or build their own code, right? Because mm-hmm. it's in the protocol. So basically, whoever's compliant to the protocol is now a node on the Bitcoin network. So in a sense, it's basically like it's radically open, and the transformation is not just the developer software code, but it's actually now the runtime that's become open. Mm-hmm. So that's new, and that's a really, really radically different vision that enables, what people are calling decentralization. You know, to me, I think the value of decentralization is just the creation of an alternative financial infrastructure, right? And we know factually that the existing financial infrastructure suffers from over-centralization. So, you know, and when I say decentralization, you know, I'm not religious about it. I just think that we need alternative rails that enable the system to be much more resilient.
The things that I'm finding really interesting is that although we're really hyping up decentralization, there's a lot of efforts right now to centralize the decentralization.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting concept to me. And, you know, there's a lot of initiatives by banks and institutions like that to actually take the blockchain and create their own private centralized blockchains, leveraging that infrastructure and that technology for a more centralized use.
Yeah. So, you know, since I'm kind of an open source financial infrastructure sort of zealot, I'm so welcoming of all of these efforts. So when you look at something like a JPM coin from JP Morgan, you know, Jamie Dimon's really known to be one of the kind of biggest skeptics on Bitcoin and everything else. But now he has his own kind of blockchain-based cryptographic currency payment rail system. So, you know, to me, I welcome them. Because when you look at the history of open source, and I mentioned the most valuable companies in the world in the public markets, you start to look at things like Apple and Amazon. So Apple and Amazon are huge participants and huge beneficiaries of open source, and they're very poor contributors, right? So Amazon mm-hmm. they would probably argue with me and say, oh, we're contributing plenty. But if you contrast that with like Facebook, Microsoft, and Google, mm-hmm. like those are massive contributors to open source and also beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. So what can you notice about the most powerful information technology companies in the world? Possibly the most powerful companies in the world is that they're all beneficiaries of open source. Mm-hmm. Some are contributors. So to me, when you look at the financial services market, why would it be different? So to me, there will only be beneficiaries of open source financial infrastructure and the dead, right? So in other words, like you won't be a financial service provider if you don't benefit from financial open source financial infrastructure, right? Those are going to be the most valuable financial service companies in the world. But half of those, fully half of those companies, I fully expect will be completely closed and proprietary, but they will be beneficiaries, right? They'll be beneficiaries because mm-hmm. they'll say, thank you for writing that code. Thank you for writing mm-hmm. that white paper. All that's brilliant. We're taking it. Right. And I welcome them to do that, because if you actually look at the way the economy works, it works in this mode of competition. And people who are attempted monopolists try to maintain their pricing power and their forcing power. But when you look at Apple and Amazon, like, they're great beneficiaries. So they're absolutely saying, give me the open source. I'm going to like put it behind proprietary APIs, and I'm going to control my market and create this walled garden. And the thing is it's working, right? Like, right. Apple is a super powerful ecosystem. Amazon is a super powerful ecosystem. So, like, I'm not saying, like, that doesn't work. It totally works. But the point being that there's actually an entire opposing side that contributes heavily into open source and actually reflects a more open model. So to me, the question becomes, you know, how do you look at something like a JPM coin? How do you look at something like what People's Bank of China are doing alongside Alipay and WeChat and these super powerful 900 million user messenger systems that are now used as payment rails? So if you look at those centralizers, yes, they are definitely going to own 50% of this future. So really, when you look at the future, there are only beneficiaries of open source financial infrastructure. And some of them are contributors, and others are basically just using them to power proprietary systems.
Hold that thought. Let's take a quick break and thank our sponsors. The production of the Amplified podcast has been brought to you by SocialFix Media. SocialFix is a transformational growth hacker agency focused on emerging technology platforms, video and podcast production, content marketing, and overall startup strategy. SocialFix has helped over 300 clients generate millions of dollars in revenue, fundraising, and profit. If you'd like help launching or growing your business, visit socialfix.com.
What are your thoughts on the Libra, Facebook Libra?
Yeah. So what's funny is I, you know, applauded Facebook as a significant contributor to open source. Obviously, like, they're extremely well known for things like the React framework. They've made tremendous contributions in areas like in-memory databases, NoSQL databases. Like, they're great contributors. So, you know, some people have argued to me that, oh, Libra is not real open source. Like, I'm really confused. You can go to the GitHub. It says, oh, there's an Apache license. You can download all of it. You can read all of it. It's 100% open source. The thing that they're getting angry about is more about Calibra, and they're getting a little more angry about the Libra Foundation, which is sort of a gated private foundation that controls the runtime. But, like, that's fine. You know, if you're upset about it, then maybe you can fork it. There has been an effort to fork it. I personally think that without the foundation and its founding members, which, you know, are reduced in number, but, you know, without that, like, you're losing a lot of the steam. Like, the code itself is not super interesting. So I guess the way I respond to Libra is it's great. Like, let them all come. And the reason why is the mood, again, of the honey badger, right? Which is open source doesn't mind, right? Like, it's not going to be derailed. It's not going to be stopped. So, like, why is it? It's not worried, right? It's super unworried about all these things. People are worried that Facebook will take over. It's like, take over what? They can't.
They're trying. How do you envision down the road overcoming some of these, what people call the blockchain trilemmas of scalability in a decentralized
system? Yeah. So, you know, to me, when you think about this, like, I like to reason about this with respect to this thing I call the slider, right? So imagine a slider, and the slider is, it simply has numbers on it, and it says, it asks this question of how many people or organizations can you trust, right? So the thing that's funny about this is the slider gives you different performance characteristics depending on where you put it, right? So what we know is that if you bring the slider all the way to zero, then you get Bitcoin, which is, Bitcoin is like, I cannot trust anyone. I trust no other parties. I trust no institutions, no humans. I don't trust anyone. So what's known is that you come down to about 7 transactions per second, right? Now, the question becomes, what are the applications for which 7 transactions per second are adequate? And it turns out that storing and transmitting value is a meaningful application for which it's working, right? So everyone's like, mm-hmm. wow. So, you know, a state-owned newspaper in China published an article that said, Bitcoin is the killer application for blockchain, right? State-owned newspaper, like, that's a big story, right? It's amazing that China's talking about it this way. And I think they hit the nail on the head, surprisingly, which is that it's fine, right? So to me, what then comes along is people are talking about novel applications. For example, the Ethereum network talks about things like a world computer. So the mm-hmm. question then becomes, okay, well, if you get some of the performance improvements in there, how many transactions per second can you get, right? And obviously, you know, there's a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth around Ethereum's lack of performance mm-hmm. because they were promised a world computer and it's not acting like one. It's not mm-hmm. fast enough to be a world computer. So, however, it was a tremendously good vending machine for what turned out to be securities.
Right.
So it vended. It's a vending machine that vended maybe $20 billion worth of securities. And, you know, that's a record. Like, that's certainly a good vending machine. But the point I want to make about this is if you can move the slider of trust to one party, I can give you a million transactions per second, right? Because I can run an Oracle database with, like, Hazelcast in-memory data grid. I can run a stack. Mm-hmm. I can buy, like, a terabyte of RAM, and I can basically, like, blow your socks off, right? So, you know, if you want any number of transactions, just move the slider to I can trust one entity, right? And so the point being that I think there's a lot of experiments, right? So if you look at EOS, it's like, oh, there are 21 entities that are block producers. And people are like, oh, that's super centralized. But if you actually look at what happened, they actually had problems because they were too decentralized. Mm-hmm. Because every 2 minutes, those 21 block producers can be revoted and shifted and changed. Mm-hmm. And it turns out things like centralized exchanges have so much EOS because, like, if you look at, like, a Binance, like, Binance holds all of their users' EOS. So if Binance wants to create block producers, they can create all the block producers they want by just manipulating their users' coins, right? Mm-hmm. So which they're doing. So the point being that, like, in some ways, that experiment is kind of challenged by over-democratizing and over-decentralizing, you know, and people complained about it being, like, too centralized. Mm-hmm. So I guess what's happening and what I want to emphasize is that what's the performance for? What are the applications that require the performance? And, you know, at the end of the day, like, how can we fix problems of trust? Because that's really where the action is, right? The action is, and the question becomes, how many parties can you trust? And what are you trying to solve by manipulating these assets on a blockchain?
So essentially, some of the questions that you have to answer when first starting to build an application or a use case is, you know, what are the needs of the users? What are you trying to achieve? What is the speed or latency that you're looking to achieve?
Yes, 100%. Because the key topic here is not TPS or transactions per second. That's not a material topic. What's a material topic? Because the reason why is that's been solved. Right, which is if you can, the key topic is trust. So if you can trust one party, then you can get a million TPS, right? And so then the question becomes, what, you know, first of all, like, what are the situations where you can't trust any one party, which is pretty much Bitcoin, you know? And then the question becomes, okay, what are the additional applications where you may want to trust additional numbers of parties? Like, for example, if you look at the United States government, it has a 3 co-equal branch structure, right, of checks and balances. So if you look at the governance technology behind that, it's like a couple hundred plus years old, and it's not on a blockchain. But it's basically running 3 nodes, and they're essentially checking and balancing each other. Are they doing so in a sort of accurate way? Are they doing so in a reliable way? Probably not. Like, they're probably struggling to do their jobs. But, like, mm-hmm. you know, the thing that becomes interesting is how many nodes do you need and what's the problem of trust? Like, who's not trusted and whose work needs to be checked? And how do you kind of, like, ensure that the system works for everyone?
What are your predictions on Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I'm not a big future prognosticator because, you know, the thing that's amazing about this is Bitcoin is just like the honey badger, and then it kind of does whatever Bitcoin wants. And so it's very hard to time markets. I'm not a market timing person. But what I can tell you is that, you know, if you base the idea of Bitcoin behind the trajectory of open source software over the past 30 years, what you're going to come up with is a very clear conclusion, which is that it's inevitable, right? So, you know, if you look at when I say Bitcoin, I'm really using the term in the broadest possible sense, which is that open source financial infrastructure is inevitable, you know, and because of its inevitability, it's going to continue to capture value, right? And it's just it's a phenomenally beautifully designed construct. And, you know, so I think from my perspective, you know, I definitely predict that, Bitcoin and its children will be, continue to be extremely valuable part of the financial infrastructure of the world, increasingly so.
So in your VC type of work, what type of startups do you look for when evaluating whether they're potential, interesting?
Yes. Yeah, so believe that this is very early, right? Because at the end of the day, what we believe is that we're in the need of rebuilding the internet. And, you know, most of the internet works okay, but there are parts of the internet that don't work well because what's happening is that value is being copied and pasted everywhere. Like, for example, your passwords, your accounts, your social security number, they're just being hacked and pasted everywhere. And that's not what you want, right? You want value to kind of stay where it is. Another thing that's being valued is your privacy and your activities and your personal life. So that's value, and that's value that's being copied and pasted everywhere and, you know, stolen from you and your data and everything. So to me, like, you know, we're rebuilding the internet on the basis of an internet of value, and that's actually going to take time. So when we look at startups and we evaluate them, what we know is it's early days for the technology. So we really look for horizontal technology. So we look for what we call layer 0, 1, and 2 solutions. You know, we also
explain that. What does that mean?
Yeah. So layer 1 solutions typically can refer to kind of new consensus models. So we're excited. For example, we invested in Space Mesh, which is using this novel space-time consensus, which is not proof of work and it's not proof of stake. So that's an extremely promising concept. So that's layer 1, which is consensus layer. There's actually this concept of layer 0 that's emerged. And layer 0 is basically the network layer, which sits underneath the consensus and accelerates that and makes it higher performant. And then layer 2 is really typically payment channels and ways of kind of doing stuff that's off-chain and it's much faster, right? So, you know, that's more like scalability. The other thing that we look at is we look at things like middleware solutions. We're investors in Origin Protocol. So we're very interested in kind of middleware, which is horizontal, but it makes the blockchain technologies and the underlying tokens more accessible and usable to applications. So we're interested in that. We also invested in a company called Agoric. And Agoric has smart contract technology that makes developers, especially JavaScript developers, very happy to build smart contracts, you know, in classical blockchain. So for us, like, the horizontal stuff is really, really valuable, the developer tool stuff, because it's early. When we go into vertical applications, we really think it's so early that there are only two application verticals that we really entertain. One of them is financial services. So, you know, we're very excited about financial services. For example, obviously Evercoin is a great example of financial services. It's an exchange. The other piece that we look at are things like the Abe exchange, which is a better exchange for doing traditional securities. So that's a really interesting space. And then the other vertical that we entertain is gaming. So we have a couple of plays there: Wax Token, Robot Cash. We have Theta Token, which is streaming, but it's streaming video of mostly gamers. So, you know, what we believe is that gaming is a very early adopter vertical for any new technology. And so because of that, we think financial services and gaming are applications that we love to look at and invest. So that's kind of what I call our L-shaped investment thesis, which is mostly horizontal and then the two verticals, gaming and finance.
What type of challenges do you feel that most companies or most startups that are developing in, you know, on the chain are going to encounter in the next 5 years?
I think that this is a challenging time. I think uncertainty is obviously a huge issue. I'd say that there's multiple domains of uncertainty. I'd say one of the uncertainties is liquidity, right? So in terms of things like, have we done any kind of blockchain IPOs? Like obviously things like Bitmain, like there's definitely ones that are candidates out there. But like with respect to liquidity, that's uncertain. The other one that's a little uncertain is the regulatory landscape and clarity. So that's another uncertainty. You know, I would say that regional liquidity around funding rounds. So at the moment, you know, the transformation has gone from like ICO, which is not a thing, to IEO, which is kind of no longer a thing. Mm-hmm. And then now it's swung all the way back to kind of venture capital as a function of this kind of very mature diligence and governance model that kind of really helps to build companies and products. So I feel like all of those uncertainties are going to weigh pretty heavily on these companies. I think the last unknown is kind of the timing for mass adoption. You know, it's our fund thesis that that's coming. We think that there's a huge divide that's emerging, which is what we call before payments and after payments. And if you're on the enterprise side, the payments are going to be coming from a bank. They're going to be regulated. They're going to be pegged to the local fiat currency. And the bank is going to tell you, this is a dollar, this is a euro, this is a yen, this is renminbi. So the bank will tell you, right? For mm-hmm. example, the People's Bank of China, the Central Bank of China, is going to point to a currency unit and say, this is renminbi, this is the local currency, mm-hmm. right? And every enterprise in the world will recognize it. They'll be right. like, we agree with you because the bank said so, right? That's what is going to happen. So the enterprise payment side is already kind of on rails. And, you know, we invested in a company called Tacit here in New York, and they're supplying their payment rails technology to Signature Bank. So Signature Bank now has a blockchain-based payment rail system. They're a multi-billion dollar bank, a terrific bank, and very forward-looking. So from our perspective, the enterprise side is going to be payment-enabled, and that's going to light the whole place up. Enterprise applications before payments are a desert. They're a wasteland. They're mostly...
And what are those?
There are people trying to use blockchain to store and transfer information, which is a mistake because it's competing against 30 years of internet infrastructure that's optimized to store and transfer information. Things like databases, right? So if you're using a blockchain as a database to store and transfer information, it's super sub-optimized for that. It's like, wow, I have a database and it does 7 transactions per second. It's like, why? Right? It's like, oh, because it's now in the enterprise. It's like, well, the enterprise has to be trusted, right? So if the enterprise isn't trusted, then there shouldn't be an enterprise, right? So the goal of an enterprise is to have an entity you can trust. So if you're storing and transmitting information out of the enterprise, you should be using a centralized database, because who is it that mm-hmm. doesn't trust your enterprise? That's a bad problem for you if they don't mm-hmm. trust you with the transactions that you're supposed to process, right? So to make a long story short, what changes the game utterly is the emergence of regulated, pegged assets, right? Because enterprises won't on balance sheet Ether, right? It's just, mm-hmm. they don't know what to do. What do the tax people do? What do the accounting people do? Everyone's super confused. They're like, this is not a thing, right? They will on balance sheet US dollars. And if a bank says this is a dollar, it's a dollar. And everyone knows what to do. Everyone's ready to go. And at that point now you have the ability to create an API economy, and you have the ability to have enterprise payments inside of these vending machines called smart contracts. And the enterprise can now expose all of its capabilities to the world in the form of these payment powered APIs. So that's like a huge explosion of creativity. And then on the consumer side or retail side, of course, payments are coming through messengers, right? So from my perspective, blockchain before payments is kind of silly because it's mostly applications that focus on storing and transferring information for which there are amazing infrastructures. The thing that we don't have is the ability to store and transfer information until now. So those are the applications that we're excited about. And obviously, once the payments arrive both in retail and enterprise, then it's kind of game on for rebuilding the internet around transferring value.
How will cryptography shape humanity?
Cryptography is an astonishingly valuable technology. It's already in use, securing things like your bank account, you know, and securing things like your government, you know. And so, like, it's really, really an instrumental, fundamental technology. And you can't have a new internet of value without cryptography, because cryptography is what's protecting your information and your assets and your data and your privacy. So, like, everything of value that's on the internet in the form of information requires protection, and it requires, and, you know, therefore requires cryptography. So the thing that's novel that's emerged in this landscape is this blockchain technology. And the blockchain technology, I think people really misunderstand it, but the simplest way of looking at it is it's a way of storing and transferring value, and the value is protected by cryptography. So, like, you know, that's a great achievement. And, you know, I think the magic that happened with Satoshi Nakamoto's Bitcoin white paper is the idea that the internet can perform a function as a fabric for storing and transmitting value with zero trusted third parties, right? That's the cool trick, right? So that at that point, that's what makes Bitcoin into an internet protocol, right? Because the internet is just protocols that everyone agrees on. And then as soon as you have agreement on the protocols, that everyone starts behaving in a coordinated fashion. And that's Bitcoin represents the first of many financial infrastructures based on this new principle.
Brilliant. In terms of what you see down the road in the different categories I'm about to kind of shoot out. Banking, we talked about quite a bit. IoT and IoV, we talked about. How about healthcare?
Yeah, so to me, the thing that's fascinating about healthcare and health records, right, is that that becomes kind of, I would say, a later adopting vertical. But, like, at the end of the day, the same principles do apply, right? And I think one of the problems that people talk about is sort of, like, how do you store and transfer information? And the thing that becomes complicated is private information becomes value, right? So one of the things that we saw, for example, is that centralized banks like Lehman Brothers were proven to be too big to fail, and then they failed, right? Which is a nightmare. But what's happening now on the internet is that data is becoming money, right? And so what's happening is we're getting these new data banks that are centralized, like Facebook, and they're too big to fail, and yet they're also failing, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing that I think is fascinating becomes what happens to things like genomic data, right? So that becomes private data that belongs to the person. So the question becomes, how do you manage that? Now, at the moment, the thing that's really complicated is that, you know, the payload of a person's entire genome doesn't itself belong on a blockchain, right? Because it's too big. Like, storing that data on a blockchain is kind of a nonsensical proposition. Mm-hmm. However, you can certainly protect it using cryptography, and you can certainly pay for it using, like, a blockchain-based payment system. So the thing becomes a question of how do you kind of preserve people's rights and privacy in a new internet concept or context, right? So things like simple things like patient records, HIPAA, and transfer of patient information, insurance information. So I think the healthcare industry has the potential to be transformed by the technology in terms of protecting and transferring the value of information and valuable information and securing privacy rights. But I would say at the end of the day, I don't see that as an early adopter. I see that as kind of a later adopter.
How about voting?
Yeah, so I think voting is definitely a big topic. I think one of the things that needs to be solved in the case of voting is we really need to solve fundamentally this concept of ownership, right? So it kind of harkens all the way back to the conversation around Evercoin, which is Evercoin is really concerned with people owning their own Bitcoins and their own cryptocurrencies, you know. So the idea becomes, like, one of the things we're introducing is with our partner Yubico, we're introducing a YubiKey that allows you to truly own your Bitcoin. So, you know, when you plug it into your phone, that's your key, you know, it's your key for your Bitcoins. So in the future, what we envision is we envision that people will have a key for everything, including their private information. So the idea is, so let me give you a feeling, right, which is that how do you, what's the feeling of owning a house? So the feeling is you've signed all of the papers and then the agent hands you the house keys, mm-hmm. right? And what's the feeling of owning a car? Okay, you've signed all the papers, and now the car salesman gives you the keys to the car, mm-hmm. right? So with respect to your bank account, with your Bitcoins, with your logins, with like everything of value on, that you have on the internet, you're not the owner mm-hmm. of any of those things, which is really sad, right? And people who are using centralized exchanges for storing Bitcoin are also not the owners, mm-hmm. right? Because they don't have the keys, right? So, you know, you have the keys that represent your ownership of the house because it allows you to access the house, right? You have the keys that represent the ownership of your car, right? So for us, what we're really trying to enable is a future where people have the keys to everything that they should own. So when you come back to your question about voting, what is voting? Voting is a right that is conferred by kind of a government, and it's conferred to a citizen. So the question then becomes, how do you preserve that right, right? So for us, the idea is that ideally a cryptographic key would represent ownership. And then the question becomes, how do you properly authenticate that person, right? So how do you properly mm-hmm. identify that person? I mean, in the case of Evercoin, we're using things like phone-based biometrics. You know, obviously the ownership of the key is a thing, right? So you own the key. But like, if someone swipes your key, then are they you? It's like, no, biometrics helps, right? So to us, like, it needs to end up being a multi-factor problem where we really need to ensure, because at the end of the day, that's individual sort of sovereign right is governed by their, you know, chosen electoral system, right? So for me, that's something of value on the network that needs to be defended and preserved using cryptography, as it were.
Marketing.
Ha, that's a twist. Say more.
How will marketing change? How will the landscape of marketers change?
Yeah,
with cryptography.
So the thing that I think will be the hallmark, and this is kind of like a really long-term view, right? Because marketing as a vertical industry is like a late adopter of this kind of tech, right? Because I think the transformation will move towards authenticity, right? Because the thing that happens now, and it will move towards consent, right? Because I think today, for example, people are doing all kinds of things. They're copying and pasting things on the internet, and they're getting things they shouldn't have. You know, they're sending emails they shouldn't send. You know, all of those things are just a function of value that's being transferred by copy-paste, and it's not being protected by cryptography. So I think in the long run, maybe 10 years out, like, you know, marketing will really have to be focused on much more authenticity and the delivery of kind of excellent products and product experiences, right? Because more and more and more will people sovereignty, you know, things like fake users, right? So it's like, oh, a lot of social media mm-hmm. is filled with fake users with fake information, mm-hmm. you know, and controlled by like troll farms, right. You know? And so, you know, if you look at something like sovereignty and voting and authentication, like all of a sudden, if you start solving those problems, then marketing transforms and it becomes much closer to product and it becomes much closer to like authenticity, right? Mm-hmm. And so that becomes more valuable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think marketing in general has a real need because right now, you know, engagement rates and impression rates and those things are really important to marketers, but a lot of them are fake and not authenticated. So if you eliminate all the fake impressions, you kind of have a more clean data.
Yeah, and again, we're kind of in the field of marketing, you know, we're probably 10 years out from solutions. So like from my perspective, like inauthenticity continues to prevail, like, you know, spam continues to fill our inboxes. Like it's really not awesome, and it will probably continue to be not awesome for the foreseeable future. You know, Facebook is like, oh, we're going to carry political ads, and like mm-hmm. that's complicated, and you know, it's a mess.
Yes, it is. Well, on that note, Miko, how do people get in touch with you? How can we find you?
Yeah, I'm very easy to find. I'm on the web. I'm on miko.com, M-I-K-O.com.
Good domain.
Yes, on Twitter, it's MikoJava, M-I-K-O-J-A-V-A. So that's my Twitter handle. So I think both of those channels are easy ways of getting hold of me, keeping track of my funny doings. You can find me also on LinkedIn. So these are all kind of places to kind of keep track of my various doings.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I think you're absolutely brilliant. And I'm going to have to listen to this podcast like probably about 10 times to absorb everything you said.
Oh, I appreciate that. So, it's been thank a lot you. Of fun. Yes. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Amplify podcast. Follow us on our social channels and subscribe on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. On the next episode, stay tuned for more trailblazing insights, energy, and culture to help fuel your pursuit in the modern digital era.